We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hello, Dragonfly Nation. This is the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast with your host, Caleb Musgrave. And today I have a really good friend of mine. I have a very good friend of mine, one of my favorite people in the whole wide world with me, Christina Yu. Christina and I met in 2011 on a tracking workshop that my buddy Ethan Huner and I were running. And Christina was a student for that. And at first there was like a bunch of people. So it was absolute chaos trying to actually get to know anybody there. But during the process, somebody found a butternut shell of a butternut. And because of how my brain was like, oh, those are practically extinct. They're not really in this area. I've never seen one myself. That's got to be a walnut. I'm like, yeah, that's probably a walnut. And Christina said, no, dude, that's a butternut. And I was like, I'm the instructor on this damn course. I know what the hell I'm talking about. That's a walnut. And then like two other people just kind of walked by and went, no, Christina's right. That's a butternut. And I went, nope, can't be. And I just kept that in my head for like a month. We argued for like, what, 5 minutes?
5 minutes. I was like, the nut was in my hand and I came up and we were looking at it and we were like, what is it? And I said, it's a butternut. And you said, no, it's a walnut. And I said, it's a butternut. And you said, no, it's a walnut. And I said, no, it's a butternut. And you said, give me the nut. So I put it in your hand and you said, oh, it's a butternut.
That's how it went, right?
Yeah. That's exactly how it
That's
went.
That's how it went. Yeah. Yes. I believe you on that because that sounds exactly like, as soon as I see it, yeah, you can't deny that's a butternut. Like, they're in completely different shape. And the rest of the day, I was like, why was I arguing so hard about that?
We talked about that after.
Oh, yeah.
There was
oh,
an understandable reason.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the funniest part was 4 years later, I found two massive butternuts on the other side of that marsh. And then I realized that's why I was so confused. We were in a cedar grove. Why would there be a butternut in here? And then less than half a kilometer away, massive grove of butternuts. Yep. It's like, oh. Right. Squirrels move nuts to where they want them to be.
I was like,
oh, I'm such an asshole sometimes.
Well, also, I think it's cool that we met over nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we're a little nuts.
Yes, that is true. So we're actually come this winter. We're celebrating our 10 years of knowing each other, which is absolutely crazy.
Yeah. I can't believe it. Are we going to have to buy each other flowers?
I'm not sure what the 10-year anniversary thing is.
Is it silver?
I'll have to look into it.
I don't know.
I'll get you like a silver dagger to protect you from werewolves or something.
Yeah, and I'll get you a silver cross to protect you from vampires.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. So, yeah, Chris, and we just kind of, after that little weird debate of me clearly being in the wrong, we kind of just started growing on each other. And about 2014, 2015, Christina took a survival primer class with us. That was the next class that you took with us, but we had bumped into each other a couple of times in between then.
Yep.
And we just kept hitting it off. And then about 2015, 2016, I think it was leading into 2016, mm-hmm. I was like, hey, you're a pretty cool person. Do you want to just work with Canadian Bushcraft?
Yeah.
And I made Christina cry.
Yes, yes. I was going to mention that. Yep. See, he gave me a dragonfly knife at his car. And, well, but just before he gave that to me, he said, I'm sorry, it's not working out. And he told me he could see my bottom lip tremble and a tear come to my eye, which it totally did. And he's like, I'm sorry. I will never do that again to anybody ever again. Here's a knife. You're doing amazing. Welcome to the team.
As context for why I did that, that's how we usually introduce our new staff. We give them a dragonfly knife and be like, hey, this will fix why you're not working out. It's like this dumb little prank we've done for years. And then I tried it for like 5 seconds on Christina. I just saw her take a serious face and try to like, you know, tough upper lip. But then I saw that bottom lip quiver twice. I was like, no, I'm not making Christina cry. I pulled the knife out and we've never done that prank again on any of our staff. We're maturing here at Canadian Bushcraft. Slowly but surely, we are maturing. So yeah, that's kind of how we started to really connect. And then in the last few years, I think since 2019, 2018?
I'm not sure.
You started asking and talking to me about hunting.
Yeah.
And asking certain questions because Christina's really into the tracking world.
Yeah.
You're a student of Alex Burnett and Chris Gilmore.
That's right.
A lot of our mutual friends, mm-hmm. People who we've had on the podcast before, like Chris. And it's incredible, the tracking world, but at the end of the day, what do we track for? Why are we tracking? Our ancestors tracked to get food on the table.
That's right.
And so I think Christina just took that natural progression and then said, okay, where do I go from here? And knowing that I lived a little closer than Chris did, and probably even Alexis, mm-hmm. and she knew I hunted.
Yeah.
It was kind of a natural progression. And so this episode is about that progression and that development as you as a hunter, and what brought you to this, what made you decide you wanted to hunt, what have you learned from hunting, what have you learned about yourself and everything else. And so that's what this episode is about.
Cue theme music.
So on that note, Christina, would you like to introduce yourself and explain like who you are and all that kind of stuff, and help kind of to paint the picture of the backstory of the Christina you of the hunting world?
Sure. So I'm sure some of you have met me before, but most of you haven't. If you couldn't gather from my last name, I'm Asian, and I grew up in Coldwater, Ontario, which is a town with one stoplight. And being the only, well, the only Asian family plus one in that town was a big informer of my life. Even though I consider myself growing up in small town Ontario and being close to the outdoors, most of my life I've actually spent in Toronto.
Right.
And like had this kind of pastoral vision of getting back to the land at some point or other. I'm also someone who's really imaginative, really into books and movies and things like that. And my godparents gave me Little House on the Prairie. Like that actual book, along with Little House in the Big Woods when I was young. And I remember reading about it and how Pa would go out into the woods and he'd see these tracks and he'd get this deer or this bear and bring it home for supper. And I was just utterly fascinated by that. I just thought, I really want to learn how to do these things. I want to learn how to build things with my hands, and I want to learn how to track animals, and I want to learn about hunting and things like this. But you know, that's a kid's fantasy. It's a kid's imagination. And later on, when I got older, I hadn't really been out on trips. I hadn't really done anything in the wild on my own. So coming out of university, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do in my life. So when I got my first job, I was like, okay, I'm going to go on an adventure. And I went to Outward Bound. I did a dog sledding course in Algonquin.
Oh, wait.
Yeah, and that's actually how I met Chris Gilmore.
Cool.
And Chris was one of the instructors with Outward Bound. It was a wonderful trip. I think we did like 5 nights and 6 days in Algonquin, just like dog sledding up and down and up and down. And it was actually one of the first things I did on my own without my parents, which was a big growth for me, you know, because I didn't know a whole lot about being outside by myself, and certainly didn't have the independence to just strike out on an adventure. So for me, this was a really big personal growth development step. Yeah, whatever. So he said at the end of the trip, you know, if you guys are interested, I'm going to be starting up my own outdoors company. It's called, what was it? It was called Sticks and Stones Wilderness School.
Well, that was Skeet.
Skeet. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I think he was working with Sticks and Stones, but I think he was running his own side gig. All of our buddies have their own side hustles.
They do, yeah.
Like Alexis has Earth Tracks, and then Chris, for a while, had Survived the Storms, and now it's just Chris Outdoors, which is where the Hunter's Journey is. That's where the Nature Awareness Program is, all that stuff. And Skeet's got Sticks and Stones. We got Canadian Bushcraft.
Yeah.
We're all teaching the same stuff. And really, at the end of the day, we're just keep subcontracting each other to do all these programs. It's like, we could just become one business, but none of us want to give up that independence.
Yeah.
So I can't honestly remember what Chris's company was like 10-something years back.
I don't remember either. But like
it may have been Sticks and Stones.
Yeah, the course was Empowering Ancient Ways, and that was my introduction to outdoor skills, right? And I think I remember describing it to people as something like a Mandarin buffet of outdoor skills, where it's like, oh, it's a little bit of fire and it's a little bit of tracking and it's a little bit of wild plants. And, you know, you got to get to run the gamut of most outdoor skills. And I remember being really taken with friction fire and then with animal tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those I really stuck with after the course. Like for years, I was working really hard on friction fire and then trying to figure out like all the intricacies of bow drill kits. And that's actually how I took my first steps as an instructor in outdoor skills, was like by running this thing called the Women's Bow Drill Challenge each winter on Facebook. And it had a big success in the first year. I thought I'd maybe get a dozen people, and I wound up with 60 who were all really, really interested, and got a lot of support from Skeet and Chris and from Alexis and all those people. And then after, so that's one piece of it. On the animal tracking side, there used to be something called the Animal Tracking Club at the Pine Project, which is outdoor skills school in Toronto, run by our friend Andrew McMartin.
Yes.
And so I went to that it was a monthly club, and it wasn't very advanced, which is fair because I was also a beginner at that point, but I was a real keener, which you might have noticed that I can
do like that. Never.
So I was a real keener and I was going to these monthly tracking clubs, but we weren't really progressing. And I was like kind of in a rut for about a year or two. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get better. And enter our friend and mentor, Dan Gardoki from White Pine Programs in Maine. And he came up to Algonquin. Apparently this is a yearly thing. He comes to Algonquin every February and he runs a 1 week tracking course. So I went and I learned so, so much and I was so inspired. I just really, really enjoyed the tracking aspects of it and the trailing and identifying all these different things. I find that tracking especially is something where like you can see direct results fairly quickly. Like I think that's applicable to any topic you apply yourself to, but with tracking, what I like about it is that it's binary, right? You're either right or you're wrong.
Right.
You know, and it's very logical to get to the right answer. Mm-hmm. So like, does it have four toes or does it have five? Does it have claws or does it not? Is it walking in this way or is it walking in this way? And, you know, all those decision tree things lead you to the right answer. And if someone says you're wrong and they can prove it logically, like you can, it's not like saying, oh, I think, I better not say this.
No, go ahead.
I think you should get vaccinated or I think you shouldn't get vaccinated. It's not an opinion sort of thing, right? It's purely based on deduction and logic. It's like playing Sherlock Holmes in the woods.
Totally. It's a dichotomic scale, kind of like the plant keys for identifying plants.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it lobed or is it basal? Is it this? Is it that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's straightforward. Yeah. You get clear answers. And I like clear answers. I don't like gray things. I mean, there's lots of gray things in my life. Don't get me wrong. It's just, you know, this is calming. It's something that I can figure out.
It's confirmable. It's confirmable and fact-based.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's what drew me to animal tracking. And totally. So I took that course with him, wound up at Alexis Burdett's with Earth Tracks. He did something called the Tracking Apprenticeship, which is a 1 year program. Definitely take it. If you're interested in tracking, go to Alexis and you're in Ontario. And they basically, I graduated. This is a little bit maybe too much getting to the end of the story. I graduated. I was his first apprentice to get a certificate in Ontario. Went on and did the cyber tracker tracking awareness.
With like Kirstie Lawrence and everybody.
Yeah,
cyber tracker.
Sorry. This is the cyber tracker evaluation, I should say. Man. Yeah. They Alexis arranged it and I went up there with my friend Lee and our friend Darcy.
Cool.
Which was so cool. And got a really high mark. I'm actually one of the highest ranked animal trackers in North America. Right. I got a score of 96. Level
Holy
three.
Crap.
Yeah. You understand what that means. Right?
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Right. And so I'm really proud of that achievement. And in the tracking world, it's something pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like it just means I tested really, really well and I worked really hard for it. So I went through this long, long, years long journey of here's an intro to tracking. Here's a tracking club. Here's a tracking course. Here's a tracking apprenticeship. And now, you know, it's like I passed the exam with flying colors. And so I feel like after that, what do you do?
Fair.
You know, and the purpose of tracking is to find the animal. Why are we looking for the animal? We want to eat the animal.
Yeah,
in like that, at least that was the original sense. Like now maybe we want to photograph the animal or maybe we want to study the animal. Lots of different reasons, but that's actually how I wound up thinking about hunting because I eat meat. I love all the meats. Many of them are so delicious, so, so delicious. And I'm Asian, as I mentioned, which means like we're really good at cooking those meats.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of take the tracking to the next level, which is I'd like to take the tracking to trailing and then to hunting. And that's how we ended up talking about that.
That's incredible. Yeah. Tracking is, there's a few ways to describe tracking. We've had a tracking session on the podcast with Chris Gilmore way back, like over a year ago, I think now. And the way I like to describe it is like, it's our very first science. Which is why I wanted to make it very clear. It's fact-based. Mm-hmm. It's science. It is the most close. It's the most ancestral scientific analysis we have. Of you go out and you observe those tracks and you figure out and theorize why they are doing that. And you check your results by finding the animal. Mm-hmm. Of, this evidence of certain pressure releases telling me that this animal might have an injury on the left leg of some, either the front or the hind, I'm not quite sure, mm-hmm. but it seems to be limping. Mm-hmm. And then you get up there and you find this deer that's got a giant gash in its leg mm-hmm. from where it got chased by a wolf and slammed itself into a rock. There's your facts. Yeah. Your facts came out clear. Your theory was correct. Your hypothesis is now proof, mm-hmm. proven. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about it. Yeah. The other reason I love it, just like you, it brings me to an animal and I'm hunting.
Yeah.
But the other way to look at it is like you're also reading the newspaper.
Yeah.
Every morning. There's an old Dobie Jahansi like philosophy around tracking. Is like you read the newspaper, I read the ground. Is an old philosophy of the people of the western parts of Africa. And when you look at those tracks, those are the new tracks from yesterday and last night, the older tracks from 2 days ago, the older tracks from a week prior to that. And you can figure out the story of what's been going out on that land every single day. But as Christina said, it ends with what are we tracking for? Yeah. And so from there, you decided to get into hunting. You decided you were like, okay, is this something that I want to get into? Is this something I want to do? Walk me through that. What was going through your head when you were thinking about hunting, when you first thought about the subject of, oh, maybe I should get into hunting?
Well, like... first, I should say like most kids, I grew up with Nerf guns.
Right.
And so I've practiced hunting my brother and sister or, you know, hunting trees in the backyard and aiming and firing. And it didn't really seem to me like a really big deal.
Right.
But as I got older, thinking about hunting, I certainly encountered the stereotype of, you know, the redneck hunter.
Elmer Fudds.
Yeah. Who's in the woods in their plaid jacket, you know, just shooting off things and there's beer cans all over the ground. And mm-hmm. so it was it's kind of a negative, you know what? It's not kind of, it is a negative stereotype. Totally.
It's a stigma.
Yeah. That hunters are unintelligent or they don't care mm-hmm. about what's going on. And they're just a bunch of yahoos who are interested in shooting guns, totally. You know, in the backwoods. So that's, you know, the stereotype is what I encountered about hunting first. And so I wasn't quite sure about who I'd encounter if I went hunting, right? Like making the decision to go hunt was for me, also a little bit of a responsibility because if I'm a meat eater and I can't take the life of the animal who I'm eating, then do I really have a right to eat as much meat as I am?
Fair.
Because the meat that we eat now is mostly coming from a grocery. Mm-hmm. We don't really associate, some people don't really associate the meat with the animal.
Yeah.
And that relationship is a little bit less strong than it should be. I think if we were more interested in where that animal had come from and what kind of life it had, we'd have much stricter regulations around food and around farming. Not to say that they're not strict. They are. I'm a civil servant, so I'm aware of them. Mm-hmm. But things like commercial farming in the United States might be more heavily regulated. Might be.
True.
You know, or in Canada, we might have more strict regulations around who, like biosecurity and who can go on, who can go off. And is it really healthy to have such huge monocultures of species?
Right.
So, you know, I felt like I needed to go on this journey, you know, as a human being, mm-hmm. as a meat eating human being. And so I felt like this is a step I need to take somehow or other. And fortunately, here's Caleb in my life, and we were friends, and mm-hmm. I knew that you hunted. So I had been a little bit exposed to your hunting culture, which was different, right? Mm-hmm. Like for you, it's very much a way of filling your freezer so that you can live through the winter, you know, and get to the spring. You're feeding your family, quite literally. And you're also feeding the elders and people around the reserve. And like, it's a really responsible, very community and family-oriented way of approaching hunting. And I thought, you know, he's offered a couple of times to take me on a hunt. And I do feel this way about the food that I eat. So I think with him, he's a very safe guy. I know he cares about what's going on around him and he cares about me. So you know what? I do feel like I want to take this step with him. I didn't really want to go to an outfitter or to a guide because of those stereotypes. And I did feel like I wanted to bring this up. In the 2000s, so when I was just coming out of university, there was an incident very close to the town where I grew up in Coldwater. It was actually like a really a berry kind of thing. Do you remember nipper tipping? Nipper tipping?
So, I swear I know what that is, but I'm not sure.
So what it is like this made the news. What was going on was Asians from the city were going up north into like the GT greater Golden Horseshoe to fish.
Right.
And the suspicion among the locals was that they were fishing without licenses, filling up trucks full of fish and shipping the fish in these trucks to the Asian grocery stores.
That's not how that
and
works.
Like, you know, selling them on the counter. This was the rumor that was going around. And of course, an element of vigilantism crept up, and the locals were going around attacking the Asian fishermen. So they'd go over and they'd demand to see fishing permits. You know, like, they wouldn't call the OPP. They just go over there and like, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be fishing here. Show me your license. And eventually this culminated in a couple of friends getting harassed. One was Caucasian. The other was Asian. They were harassing the Asian one. And the Caucasian stepped in and to defend his friend and wound up with permanent brain damage. Like, they wound up
Holy
in a coma.
Shit.
And the person who attacked him was convicted of something really quite serious. He was put away in prison for a long time, but he appealed it. And the entire time he was arguing, he was justified in attacking this person. And I don't remember the outcome of that, but look it up because it was in the news. So I had a lot of fear about going by myself into the woods with strangers, like people I didn't trust.
That's 100% valid.
You know? Yeah. And I think a lot of racialized people feel that way because like, if you think about it, there's a really long history of people being taken into the woods and then something bad happening to them, right? Away from prying eyes. And so these were the things that were going through my head when I was thinking about hunting. I want to go with someone I trust and I want to be responsible.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Wow. Yeah. I hate having to say this, but I've had that conversation with a lot of my racialized friends. Like, I think every single one has that fear. Just like to put into perspective, I'm white passing as hell. I look more like William Wallace than Sitting Bull across the board. But I was raised indigenous. Like I was raised knowing cousins of mine and people we knew who are now MMIW. Mm-hmm. And people who, young Native men who got beat up by cops. Mm-hmm. And I personally know two people who had Starlight tours done to them up in Northern Ontario and over in Saskatchewan. Yeah. Like it is the case. It's reality. We can't deny that. And I think now we're starting to acknowledge that more in public.
Yeah.
I think the media has started to pick that up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it's going away. And so that fear is still there.
Yeah.
A good friend of ours who is originally from Guyana, his family's originally from Guyana. He's born in Canada, but he's half Indian and actually he's half Indian, half Chinese. Mm-hmm. And because of that mix and because of where he grew up, he looks visibly brown.
Yeah.
He's a brown, big brown man. And he loves being in the woods. He's one of my favorite people to go camping with. He's one of my favorite people to go hunting with. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't like to broadcast that he goes hunting.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like to broadcast that he's an outdoorsman. And so he will grow facial hair like many outdoorsmen do, but he'll grow it as clean and prim and proper as possible so that he doesn't look like, and I hate saying it this way, a Muslim terrorist. Because he does not want to be that guy out in the woods who gets harassed by the rednecks for looking like a Muslim terrorist, which is heartbreaking. I have a lot of Muslim friends, and I hate the fact that this happens, that the stereotype is, he himself is not even Muslim.
Yeah.
But, in fact, I believe he's Catholic.
Yeah.
But regardless, that's the fear in him as a brown man in the woods, is that he's going to get harassed for being a terrorist, and he's going to get potentially shot because he's going to be out there when it's hunting season.
Yeah.
And so he makes sure that he hunts with people that are white passing. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because he's friends with them and they're the ones that take him hunting. Mm-hmm. But B, because he knows that they will help protect him because, well, he must be okay because all these white guys are with him.
Yeah.
So it's 100% valid.
Yeah.
What you just described. It's 100% valid.
Yeah.
And it's important to talk about.
Yeah. And like, later, and probably in another podcast, we can talk about the different stereotypes racialized people in the woods have to battle, because they're all different.
Mm.
So yeah, that's a rich topic. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute.
Totally. Well, we're definitely talking about that eventually. I just got to get everybody together for that. That podcast has been in the works since May of 2020.
Yeah.
And it's just trying to get the right people in the right spot mm-hmm. to talk about it mm-hmm. because I don't want to have to try and like interview you for 5 minutes and then go and interview another person for 5 minutes and then try to stitch that all together. I'd rather have us do a round table where everybody can kind of bounce off each other and have that conversation mm-hmm. openly and freely. Getting all emotional in here.
All right.
But yeah. So you chose to go with me because you felt safe.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. I'm really glad to hear that people feel safe with me.
Like, we're friends. If I didn't feel like you were safe, we wouldn't hang out.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. If I didn't feel safe around you, we wouldn't be hanging out because you're terrifying.
Really? Oh.
You're a karate master.
Shh. Don't give that away. That's my secret weapon.
I got to, just to clarify to everybody, Christina is one of my favorite people. And as much as she plays herself off as like this nice, caring person, she's a badass. At the same time, she is an absolute badass.
Only sometimes.
All the time.
No.
All the time. I've seen you track. I've seen you carve wood. The work you do, the amount of effort like you put in, as you're saying earlier, you're a keener.
Yeah.
And so like I remember I helped you make a crooked knife blade.
Yep.
And the next time I saw you, you had a hand carved piece of tiger striped maple that you had carved to look like the body of a dragonfly.
Yes. Yes, because we were talking about the dragonfly knives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is like above and beyond what you had to do for this handle. Mm. And it's like so good. And that's just like, you're such a badass. It's why I enjoy hanging out with you. I try to surround myself with just badass people. And it's been successful so far.
Yeah.
It makes me feel more badass because I have more badass people around me, like you and Ryan.
Yeah.
And Radic and Ben and my wife, of course, and everybody else. It's so important to me to have badass people. And
all those guys.
When you came to me and you're like, I want to get into hunting. Can you show me some stuff? I was like through the moon. I want you to know that. I was through the moon. I like told 5 people in 5 minutes. So I'm taking, I was like, it was Chris Gilmore, Chris Kong. Yep.
The Chris's.
Yeah, the Chris's. Yep. All of our mutual friends. Yep. I was like, I'm taking Christina hunting. And they're like, cool. They didn't seem as excited as I was. I'm like, you don't understand. This is the greatest day ever. This is like Christmas and a birthday and bar mitzvahs and everything all combined. It was great. But so you started coming out with me and what did you, so what were the steps you had to go through from there?
The first step was to take the hunter safety education course.
Right.
And to get my Canadian firearms safety certificate. Yes, I think that's the right terms. And so I signed up for one of those 2-in-1 courses over in Toronto and mm-hmm. I got that done really quick. Excellent, excellent course, like highly recommended. They gave us so many great tidbits about maintaining firearms and where to get used firearms and all these other great things mm-hmm. for novice hunters. So like got that course done. The next thing was to figure out, well, this part was already done with me, but who am I hunting with and when?
Right.
And so we figured out we wanted to do like a duck hunt because that was the best way to introduce someone. It's kind of like the Nintendo game.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. That was pretty fun. The Nintendo game. Yeah. Da 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 da. And then we got my first gun. Yeah. Which was not my first gun in my life. I had an air rifle, and I certainly had a large collection of Nerf guns, but
of course,
yeah, an actual fire alarm. We wanted to go and get a shotgun, and that felt like a big deal for me because I've never owned a real actual firearm that could hurt someone, and so it felt like a big step.
Totally,
yeah. And so you and I were looking for a shotgun that would fit me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, well, let's go shoot some of my guns first, and. We'll find some firearms in the collection and we'll try them out. So we had like a 22, we had a bolt action, I think, mm-hmm. and a pump action 12 gauge. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, like this is in no way, a lot of people will say things like, oh, 20 gauge for a woman. No, yeah. No, that's bullshit. That is absolute bullshit. Anyone can shoot a 12 gauge. Anyone can shoot a 20 gauge. Anyone can use a 410. I don't care what the firearm is. I don't care what your age, gender identity, your sex, whatever. I don't care about any of that. You can shoot the gun. Are you comfortable with the gun?
Yeah.
Is the question at the end of the day.
Does the gun fit you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to get into. The big difference here between Christina and I is not our gender identity or our sex. It's our size.
Yeah.
I am 6'1" and I am 330 minimum. I'm a woolly mammoth in human form. This is just the human avatar of the woolly mammoth. Mm-hmm. You are not.
I'm Avatar Aang, basically.
Yes.
Right? I'm yes. 5'6". I'm 100 pounds soaking wet. There are three of me in Caleb, quite literally.
Literally, yeah. And figuratively. There's three plus a little bit of extra.
Yeah.
So you can throw like a thigh in there or something.
Yes.
Man, yeah. And so I gave Christina my shotgun that I've used for years because I really appreciate that system of that gun. I really like the 870 model Remington. They're a really good shotgun. Mm-hmm. And Christina was having trouble reaching. Sorry, folks, we just had a little bit of a hiccup there. I like the 870 because it's a very simple system. It's something that I really do like. And so I was like, okay, have this, try this. There's the target. And Christina had trouble reaching the forend.
Yeah.
Because it's such a long gun.
My arm was like fully extended and just barely could grab the forend. And the stock was so long that I had to go like around, bend my elbow. It was like I was hugging a basketball in one end.
Yeah.
Because it was just such a huge gun in proportion to me.
And for some stupid reason in my head, because I'm that guy that you see this all the time, the videos of like the boyfriend gives his girlfriend the gun and lets her shoot it while he videotapes and laughs at her.
Yeah.
I am not that person. No, I do not appreciate that stuff. Do not do that to people. A, you're hurting somebody. B, you're hurting their trust in you. Yeah. And C, you're potentially hurting someone else if they mishandle that firearm. Mm-hmm. Like, this is an actual weapon that kills things.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? From my perspective, what I was seeing was like, okay, she's a little uncomfortable. I think she's just a little bit nervous with it because it's a big gun. I'll just let her take one round and see how she feels after that. And that was the mistake. I should have said like, okay, this gun doesn't fit.
Yeah.
The gun was completely safe the whole time. The gun didn't go anywhere. It's a single shot at a time. It's not semi-automatic or full. Well, semi-automatic is one shot at a time, but it's not like a full auto. It's not able to go like crazy and hurt anybody else. But when the round went off, the stock jumped off your shoulder.
Did
right
it?
Back. Yeah, it came back. It looked like you were holding a bazooka.
Oh, wow.
For half a second. And that's when like I ran over and grabbed the gun. Mm. And we were like, okay, we're not going to do that again.
Yeah. From my perspective, I heard this, like this really big blam. And then the gun like leapt up. I was like aiming, well, below the horizon. It went basically straight up in the air.
Yep.
You know? And I was like, okay, that's not the gun for me.
Yeah. And it was a very nerve-wracking, that was in the late summer.
Yeah.
And then we were like, okay, we need to get you a gun. Let's look at some other options. And I was still very much of the opinion that anyone can shoot a 12 gauge. Mm-hmm. I still believe that. Mm-hmm. You can shoot a 12 gauge.
Yep.
Are you going to be comfortable with a 12 gauge? And that's my new philosophy since this time. Like I've learned in this process with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, are you comfortable with the gun though? Anyone can shoot a 300 Win Mag or a 30-06. If it kicks and you don't like the kick, you're not going to be a very good shot.
No, and you're not going to want to go hunting either.
Exactly.
So what's the point? Yeah.
So I was still like, okay, we'll find a youth model 12 gauge and all this. Like maybe it was just the sheer size of it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I listened to Christina. And Christina said, I don't know if I like 12 gauge.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to a gun shop. We found a Bantam model.
Yep.
Mossberg that's in 20 gauge.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I think everybody should have a 12 because I believe in like, as silly as it sounds now to think back of it, the larger the shell, the more powder it has, therefore the more projection it has, but also the more pellets it can have for birdshot, the more weight the slug will have for deer hunting, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I always believe more is better
mm-hmm.
when it comes down to making sure that kill is the cleanest, fastest kill possible. But I have to balance that with if they're not comfortable with the effing gun, they're not going to make a good shot.
Yeah.
If at all.
Yeah.
So what's the point?
Yeah.
So we took it out. Christina shot it. And that was the most, the look before and after of you, when you took your first shot with that 20 gauge.
Yeah.
I don't want to say like, you were so nervous. You weren't,
yeah.
It was, you were not comfortable. You were not confident with this.
No.
You're ready to do it. You're going to do it. This is going to suck though.
Mm-hmm.
And then you squeeze the trigger, press the trigger,
yep.
The round goes off, and it was night and day.
Yeah.
You looked so happy. Your eyes lit up, your smile went from ear to ear, and you're like, that didn't suck at all.
Those are the exact words you said. I did say that.
And so we found the right gun for you.
Yeah.
And that's like that's the biggest challenge for most newcomers is finding the right gun for you. And this was like the biggest challenge because everybody else I've ever helped, a 12 gauge worked, what people call a regular size, but I would rather call like a big shotgun,
sure,
like an 870 Remington or Mossberg 500. Yours is a Bantam 550.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
Yeah. So that's the Mossberg Bantam, and Bantam just means it's smaller, like a Bantam duck or a Bantam hen. They're a smaller breed.
Yeah.
It's not a youth model or a girl model, like a lot of people used to call them. Bantam is the right term for it. It's just a smaller version. Mm-hmm. All the parts work the same way. You can watch a Remington 870 video on how to take apart your gun, and a Remington 870 Bantam will work the exact same. Mossberg 550 the same way as a Mossberg 550 Bantam. Mm-hmm. They're challenging to take apart and put back together, but they're not a bad gun. The Remington 500, Remington 500s, that'd be a weird one. Remington 870s and the Mossberg 500s, they're pretty much on par for the course. And 20 gauge worked for you.
Yep.
And that's the end of that story, really. Is like it functions for you. And you've shot it quite a few times with me now, and you're pretty good shot with it, actually. Your patterning when we were practicing it last year was pretty decent.
Yeah.
You had pretty good pattern. so that was like the biggest, that was the first road bump was, okay, mm-hmm. I'm kind of nervous with this gun. Now I'm gun shy. And then we got you the right gun, and the gun shyness went away. Yeah. Now you're confident with that gun, and you shoot well with the gun now, and now you're ready to hunt with it.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the next part of that. So you got yourself your firearm, and then where did we go from there? Where did your experience go? You got yourself a shotgun that worked for you. You set yourself up, practiced with it, and then what?
So a couple of things happened, because I think a lot of people find themselves in this situation of being all like, okay, I got a gun, I got a permit. Now what do I do? So we kind of skipped a little, well, we didn't skip a couple of steps. I had a couple of steps in place, which is I had a place to hunt because here's my friend Caleb and he had a place to hunt. And I had people to hunt with. And I talked about how, you know, you and the Young Bucks were my group to hunt with. But as to tactics, I didn't have a whole lot to go on. So you gave me a couple of resources. You pointed me in the direction of Meat Eater, like the Netflix show.
Yep.
And then I also enrolled in the beta version of The Hunter's Journey, which you've been talking about for the past few weeks with Chris Gilmore. Yeah, and he talked about, you know, for this kind of game, you might want to consider this firearm and this tactic. And for that one, you might want to think about these strategies. And, mm-hmm. and that helped a lot, being like, okay, if you're going after waterfowl, this is the kind of equipment you need. And these are the places you might need to think about going. And this is the stuff you got to get, right?
Right.
And so that, since that was like the lowest cost entry point, I think that was why I thought, okay, Caleb does duck hunting. He's really keen on me trying it. It seems really accessible. Anyone can go duck hunting. Let's try that. And so that's where I went next.
There was also, you came up for a weekend the year before the pandemic. So 2019, fall of 2019, mm-hmm. I think it was in late August, early September or something like that. We went out for a weekend to practice deer stalking.
Oh yeah.
I just remembered that about an hour ago. I was like, oh wait, didn't we do this as well?
We did. That was like way of the deer stalker course.
Yeah, we did that. That one was just with you and me, though, because we had a bunch of fiascos with getting courses run in the second half of 2019. It was really hard to get classes running at that time for a bunch of logistical stuff. Nobody needs really have to hear about that sob story from me. But we basically said, screw it, come up anyways, let's just do this.
Yeah.
And we went out the first day, it was pouring rain, it was humid. Yeah. And I was observing you come through the areas and stalking through, giving you some pointers. And then the next day we went out real early and there was a doe and two fawns playing in a field like 80 yards from us.
Yep.
And that that was cool. That was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we also found so much bear poop.
Yeah, we did. You put your hand right on some.
It was so warm.
Yeah. So
I know. That was surreal how, like, there was this one pile of scat. Christina and I saw the deer and then we scouted onward and then we came back to where we were just 20 minutes before and there was warm steaming bear poop where we had been standing 20 minutes prior. And I'm like, oh, okay, I've got a walking stick. We should head home.
It was an apple poop too. I remember that distinctly. And then you put your hand right on it and you told me, oh, it's still warm. And I was like, ah, I'm glad you did that. Because I'm not going to do that. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then you went on, I think the first thing you did was go on a duck hunt with us. You came out for a day with Adam Hopkins and I believe.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the fall of 2019, I think.
And that was on the rice flats, right?
Yeah, yeah, that was over. So where Christina's talking about is just off the reserve, there's a stretch of land that is Ducks Unlimited property that is public access. Anyone can go there and hunt, although access is really limited. There's one side of the trail is private property and they don't allow people there. The other half is through the reserve. And since I'm a resident, we parked my vehicle kind of thing and went up and walked in and went for a hunt. And we didn't see squat. There was no ducks flying that day. But no. that was the first time was we just sat out for 3-4 hours and then went, okay, there's nothing flying. We should head home.
Yeah, and but that wasn't a disappointment for me because I'm definitely a night owl, and so seeing the sunrise is something I'm not used to doing at all. But we're out there just as first light was coming up, so barely enough light to see, you know, stumbling around in the dark, and we kind of parked ourselves along the shore edge, and I remember watching the sun come up and thinking, so this is why photographers always get up at dawn, because it was just so beautiful and so still, and there was mist coming off of the water, and you know, like you said, we didn't see squat, so it was so tranquil and so peaceful. So it was a really beautiful experience, and you flagged in that Canada goose from way across the flats that flag. Yeah, and it came in and you shot at it like 5 times and it didn't die, but you yelled, hit the deck. So I hit the deck and I rolled over onto my back and I was watching you shoot at this duck. And you were like, I swear the skin's made out of Teflon. Cause it kept like reflecting all these bullets off of it. And it wouldn't die.
I couldn't believe that. I had time to load 2 more rounds and shoot at this goose. And it just wouldn't. And it was so strange because like everything was saying it was in range. Everything was saying it was in range. And I learned something from that. I was like, I need a bigger choke on my gun if I'm going to keep doing waterfowl as hard as I am. And I bought myself an extended full choke, one of those ones that goes like an extra 1.5 inches out of the barrel and chokes the barrel down even more. And since then, I've had a lot less misses, I can tell you that.
Oh, there you go. Nice. Way to go, dude.
Yeah. And then last year. So that was 2019 was when we went out the one day. And then last year we went out for a couple of days of waterfowl, yeah. Different types of waterfowl hunting, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And that was on your friend's property where you had the blinds. And so we split up into 2 parties. And our good friend Chris Gilmore came one of those days. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, what an experience. Because I wasn't prepared for the physicality of it. I think I talked about this before at one point. You know, having this really heavy gun and this really heavy pack in these really awkward boots that have no tread on this uneven terrain,
right,
where you're in the dark is really difficult to navigate. And like, you know, if I had thought about it more, it would have been like, oh, I'm going to be traipsing through the woods like I usually would. It would have been like, no, you're kind of going to be on a balance board with all this other stuff that you're not typically used to carrying going out in the dark. So practice blindfolded juggling with really heavy kettlebells and you might be prepared. Yeah, but
yep.
Yeah, that part was surprising to me, but it was still so much fun because just like the first hunt, you know, beautiful sunrise. It was very peaceful, except for our super incompetent, but my super incompetent duck and goose calling. And, you know, here you are with a bunch of friends that you really enjoy playing the Imperial March like a mallard.
I keep forgetting about that and then remembering about it and laughing like an idiot again. We were out there from like, I don't know, 6:30 in the morning, like well before sunrise, we were in that blind and we stayed out until almost 11.
Yeah.
And by about 10, you could tell both you and I were getting kind of manic. Like, okay, nothing's coming in, nothing's going on. And so we just started like playing with our calls, and you start practicing like Ride of the Valkyrie, and then yes, start practicing
and then you put Imperial it on your March. Phone. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You. Yes, I did. I can't find that recording anywhere. But yeah, we. That was an interesting day because for me, from my perspective, it's like, okay, we're here with Chris, who has a lot of experience waterfowl hunting, and me, who has a lot of experience waterfowl hunting, and one of our like shared students. Like, you've been a student of mine for hunting. You've been a student of his for tracking and nature awareness. It's like, so we're both coming out as like almost like Papa Bear times two,
yeah,
with our little cup, and we're going to go out into the woods and show them the ways. And nothing was what we were expecting it to be. And I think the funniest part for me was at one point Chris said, okay, I think nothing's coming in. I think we should just head out. I got to get back all the way up to Huntsville and let's just pack it in. Like, I don't know, man, like midday is when those ducks like to come in to feed. And I remember he gets up and unloads his gun and starts walking out of the blind. And then you got up to follow him. And I was like, okay, I guess I should start following. And you and I kind of got, how can I put it? We're kind of milling around for a second, getting our guns unloaded, when 80 teal landed on the other side of the pond.
Yep.
Like, no word of a lie, 80 teal land. And you and I both start loading our guns quietly again and creeping back into position. Chris catches on and puts a round in and just goes as loud as a shotgun can ever be. And all those ducks just take off the opposite direction. We both look back at Chris and goes, yeah, that was on me. That one was on me. I screwed up. And like, yeah, sure. But then we saw them moving and they were moving around more again. So we all got back into the blind kind of as quick as we could. And a couple of us had a chance to pop off some shots. And we all missed. It's this beautiful, like, everything was almost perfect. But we were just out of range. And I actually range found that spot the next day. Where those ducks had landed was 70 yards from us. So we never had a chance of hitting them with pellets. We never had a chance. But because of how that area is so narrow and wide, short and wide. It's a wide pond, but yeah, not a very deep pond. It was really like an optical illusion. We were like, okay, those are teal. Those must be at like 30, 40 yards. That's well within lethal range with these shotguns. And then the next day when I sat down in the same blind, I'm like, I need to pull my rangefinder out and look. And I just hit a cattail that was right out where those ducks had been. And I was like, that is 70 something yards. So like, again, even I'm learning on these little experiences. And I think that's why I enjoy bringing new people out hunting with me, is because I'm still learning with them. And it was just a real experience of being like, that is double the distance we should have been shooting at. No wonder none of us dropped a duck. Okay. Now I know for sure for next year that we need to make sure that we have like a gauge of like our decoys are now our distance. And if the ducks aren't over our decoys, we don't shoot. And also maybe we need to move our blind to that side, because every time I've been there since, that's where the ducks seem to land, not over near where we were. So yeah. But yeah, just these surreal moments of like playing on the call, playing on the duck calls and figuring out different calls, showing Christina how to call, and then being like, okay, now screw that up completely and play something musical on it. You've got a background with instruments though, don't you? You were telling me at one point, trumpet.
Playing the piano.
Piano.
I played the trombone, and so that's how I could hit all the pitches. That's my test in grade six. Was I had to play Happy Birthday on my trombone mouthpiece.
Wow.
And I was like, a mallard call. This is nothing in comparison. It's so easy.
Yeah.
But getting back to the duck story, I think I remember that a little bit differently than you, Caleb.
Oh.
Yeah, because I remember like the three of us were leaving and I turned around and these ducks came in and I was like, guys, ducks. And I hit the ground. And then we were arranged in this kind of backwards triangle position where you and me were on front, but Chris was back.
Yeah,
it was the noise of him loading the shells that actually scared the ducks away.
Yeah,
because he was standing there popping them in, and he never actually chambered the shell. But just that sound made them take off.
Right? I could have sworn then, I heard him chamber. You might be right though.
And then, like when we were going to fire at them, and this was a newbie thing. Like, this was my sort of kind of learning. Like, I was really scared that the spread of this pellets was going to smack me in the back of the head. So I actually never fired. I just like hit the deck. I took a knee and I was like, the two of them are going to fire. Caleb's on my right and he's not going to hit me at all. But Chris is behind me and I really don't want to be, you know, that scene with Russell Crowe on that ship where he accidentally shoots that guy's arm off or whatever. So I was like, okay, I'm going to hit the deck. And so like that, I don't know. I think that kind of brought home for me how important it is to hunt with people who I know and mm-hmm. who I trust, right? Because like in that moment, I'm like, okay, is Chris going to blow my head off? And like, I didn't know, but of course he wouldn't have because he's a really experienced and safe hunter.
Yes.
But in that moment of like paranoia and fear not being out before, I was like, okay, I don't know. So I'm just going to be safe. I'm going to take a knee.
See, I forgot that you didn't shoot.
I'm going to be calling Kaepernick.
Yeah, yeah.
I shot earlier when we saw that other flock of ducks.
Yeah, we did have a little flock go over us.
Yeah.
It was such weird weather that day, and the ducks were coming from really unexpected directions. We also had that heron that was like,
yes,
screaming. It did, because I remember there was ducks up ahead, so I shot, and I didn't realize that heron was like behind us, and it started screaming in terror. And it made me scream in terror for a second because I did not know that bird was like right, like behind me to the left up in a dead elm tree. And I just went bang. And there's just, you just hear, wah, 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 wah. I'm like, I thought I was getting attacked by a pterodactyl.
And it was a very angry pterodactyl because it kept circling us and it kept yelling for like quite a long time.
Quite a while.
Yeah. We were musing about maybe shooting at it, and then you're like, no, we cannot. That's, I'm a Heron clan person.
Yeah, that's my clan. Yeah. We can't be taking a shot at my family.
Yeah.
They'd be getting mad at me.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. So yeah, goose hunting, duck hunting, and then this year was deer hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was so different.
That was interesting. So for those who are not aware, this Christina came up to my place 3 days ago. Was it 3 days ago? Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It's Sunday now. So you left today. So it was, 3 days ago you came up. And from Friday until Saturday evening, we hunted. So from Friday morning till Saturday afternoon, we hunted. And you had some experiences with us. We went out with a couple of different friends.
Yeah.
And they're all part of this crew that we call the Young Bucks. And that's just like our hunting group. It's not like a club or an organization anybody can join. It's just like what we call our group. My dad's hunting group, they're called the Belly Button Hollow, and then we're called Young Bucks because everybody was, when we first started to form the group, it was everybody under 40. It's like, okay, well, these are all, a lot of them are newcomers and they don't have a lot of experience, so we're going to try and teach them the kind of stuff that me and Chris teach on the hunter's journey and all that. We're going to try and teach them like stewardship, and we're going to try and teach them like responsibility of the land and caring about what we do and actually hunting with your heart. But we got a few of them out for this weekend with you. And I remember what happened from my end for this past weekend. It was quite an interesting experience from where I was. But you were, as the newcomer, and this is your first time deer hunting. What was this all like for you? What was it like getting out there and experiencing, hunting with other people with slug shotguns, and having the potential like safety concerns, but also like having to actually coordinate things as a team to try and bring the animals home, and potential wildlife spottings that you may or may not have had. I'll let you tell whatever stories you want to tell. So just tell me what it was like to deer hunt. Let me know what this was like as your first time.
So, okay. First, I need to talk a little bit about waterfowl hunting, because with waterfowl hunting, it's all about getting into position and then hiding. And hoping they kind of run in. So I described it as kind of like that midway game where they turn on, where you're in that glass case and they mm-hmm. turn on those really strong hair dryers and spray cash all around you, and you have to run around and catch it, right?
Right, because
you don't know when the ducks are coming, right? It's speculation. Mm-hmm. But with deer hunting, you do have an idea of when they're coming. And like, hopefully it's between sunup and sundown, but you have a little bit of foreknowledge by setting up these game cameras, and you also have foreknowledge because you can track the deer across the land, which you can't do with waterfowl. Right. You can see their scat, you can see their scrapes, you can see their rubs, and you've got the trail cam footage, and you've also got topography tracking, which which you talked a lot about on the Hunter's Journey, in talking about you know, the wind direction and ridges and valleys and all these other things that affect their movement. And so, like, that was kind of a little bit less about hide and seek and more about almost like the game of war, you know, which is not to say like that we're enemies or anything, but certainly we're seeking out an opponent. We're seeking out the wily deer. Yeah. And trying to lay a trap for them, or lay in, wait for them to get there. Yeah.
Almost like we're trying to ambush them. We're staging
an ambush.
Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. Right. And so it's like a little bit of a different mindset. And I just thought it was so much fun because as the person who didn't know the property, it was easiest for the other people in the group to be moving around the property because they know what it's like. And not that it's so huge that you could get lost, but, you know, why take chances on your first time trying to set up for success? So I'm the one who got to go up into like this little crow's nest, like your friend Matt's tree stand, which he had built. And just like, Christina, we'd like you to dress up in camouflage so you can hide from everything, go up into this awesome tree fort in the middle of the night, and we're going to hand you this cool firearm that you love to shoot. And then we're going to stick some deer in front of you. Like, you're going to be at the feeding station where all the deer come. And you remember that scene in the Oregon Trail where you're like, because every child I know who played the Oregon Trail only like they bought like 400 bullets and then they would hunt the digital buffalo and the deer. Yep. And that was the whole game. Yeah. So that was me in this tree stand, like for all 3 days, as far as I was concerned. I'm just like waiting for that digital deer to like walk in front of me so that I could, you know, well, I could get a deer. So that was a ton of fun. So what story do I want to tell? Well, the first day was really quiet. We didn't see any deer, but it was so much fun to listen to the bird language. I highly recommend he edited it, but there's this book called What the Robin Knows, and it talks about bird language and how you can use this kind of the calls that they make as a kind of radar to tell what's going on around you. And so, for example, when you came to get me in the later in the day, I could hear all the birds telling me that you were coming. By the way that I could hear them yelling at you, then I could see them flying in front of you. It's just like a magnet with those iron filings when you've got the negative pole. Yeah. Like, they just fly away from you. It was like you had a huge massive force field. So that was really fun for me on the first day. And then the second day, I was back in the tree stand, and this was in the evening, and nothing was happening, but it was just really, really beautiful. The sun was going down, and it's just like beautiful, clean air. And this big black bear came out of the woods, and it just came around like the end of one branch and circled around, and it just kind of stopped and looked towards the feeding station, which is right in front of me. And then it sat on its bum. It sat on its bum just like a little kid and looked right where the tree stand was. And I'm like, can it see me? Can it see me? I know deer can't see orange very well, but maybe bears can. So I was like moving very slowly, you know, trying to reach for my phone and get this on video. And the bear decided, you know, something about that food plot doesn't seem right. And it just kind of left. And then not even 5 minutes later, the cub came around and did the exact same thing as mama. It just went around the branch, paused at the same place, looked in my direction, and then just followed her out. And it was just such a cool, cool moment because, you know, speaking of stereotypes, bears get a really bad rap. Yeah. You know, I thought this was like this, you know, human killing machine who would climb up my ladder and like bite my face off. And but there is absolutely nothing to fear. The bear saw that I was there, didn't like me, and just moved away. It had no interest in me whatsoever. And this was a mom with her cub, which is supposedly the most dangerous bear out there. And apart from that initial, oh, it's a bear, I didn't feel any fear at all of this animal. In fact, it just seemed like such a respectful and really cool interaction. And so that was so amazing to see not my first bear, but like my first bear up close in the wild, right? Like that was amazing. And then the third day, The third day, nothing much really happened. It was just like a lot of sitting, but it felt really good in the sense of thinking about camouflage, you know, like thinking about how to blend into your background and thinking about how the wind moves and where it's carrying my scent. Because the game plan for that day was that the wind was blowing across. So you guys were basically going to try to push the deer either down or up, you know, down towards us. And so like just thinking about what the deer might see if they came out of the tree line and they were looking towards me, would they see me backlit against the skyline? No, they wouldn't, because I'm choosing to sit a little bit below this hill. And would they see the color I'm wearing? No, because I'm sitting in front of this cedar and behind this little sapling, which breaks up my shape a little bit. Mm-hmm. So those were really interesting learnings. And, you know, Chris does this thing where he's like, after each hunt, he would ask, what are your takeaways from this? And I remember talking to you about, I think I need quieter gear. You know, I think I need to learn a little bit more about the color spectrum that different prey animals can see. And I need to think about practicing sitting still and shooting from a seated position and things like this. And so it got really real for me in the course of those 3 days. Whereas the waterfowl hunt was kind of like, oh, you know, this is interesting. I'm glad I came. But after the deer hunt, I was like, yeah, I want to get better at this.
For sure.
Yeah.
The deer hunt, like for me, I'm 100% a waterfowl fanatic. I love waterfowl because you don't know when they're showing up and they are like, it's like shooting acrobatically. You got to follow them. You got to lead them. You got to be able to shoot them when they're coming towards you, when they're flying away from you, when they're going left, when they're going right, when the wind is in your favor and the wind is out of your favor. You got to learn how to call, and you got to learn how to actually like manipulate the birds with your own mouth, in a sense. And there's a lot of fun there, but like deer hunting is a different level. Deer hunting, you're hunting an animal that, and Chris has said this on the podcast before, and I've said this on the podcast before, you're hunting an animal that gets hunted 365 days of the year, every single hour of every single day. This animal avoids coyote, wolf, out further west and north of us, panthers. Like they are constantly at in danger. And so when we have a chance as hunters, as humans, to defy their survival skills and in a sense win by taking a kill, it's different than duck. It's different than small game. It's the only things that are similar are other big game animals like elk or moose or caribou or mountain goat or whatever it may be that you're hunting in your region. And so there's a lot of fascination. For me, I think the biggest takeaway of this past weekend was opening day. Well, the opening day for you, the first day that you were able to get out, we put you up in the tree stand and our good friend Matt went down to what we call the exit point. And the exit point is this little corner of land against a swamp with a fence. And when the deer want to escape the property, that's where they run to. They run through that swamp and jump that fence and they're off the property immediately. And I went up to the other end of the property that we call the ridge. And I was not even, you know, 30 minutes into my push. I had just got through the first little meadow and was just walking towards the creek that kind of splits the rest of the property away from the ridge. When I heard just this muffled shotgun go off, boom. I was like, well, that was farther, like that's muffled, but it's not that far away. And so I just text Matt. I'm like, hey, was that you? And he responds, yep. I'm like, okay, that's a short answer. That's not I got him or anything like that. I better call to see what's going on. And I call him and he tells me like, I think I may have got a doe. I don't know. She was really big, but there's a lot more brush in here than I thought there was when I took the shot. It was really early in the day. It was legal light. Like he took it during legal time, but it was still dim enough in those cedars that he couldn't tell. And he decided to use buckshot, which is kind of like spread shot for birds. And that means smaller pieces of lead or smaller projectiles, which means less mass to keep them on target and less likely that they're going to be able to bust through the branches and more likely that they're going to get deflected or outright stop. And I was like, okay, stay put. That's the number one rule. Once you take a shot, do not do anything for at least half an hour. Don't go after the animal. Don't try to track the animal. Don't do anything. Leave them alone for at least half an hour with a firearm. And I was like, I'll come to you. I'm going to push the bottom of this swamp and I'm going to go pick up Christina. He's like, okay. And so I went and I got to you and you were in the zone. Like you were just set. You were ready. You were ready for action. You saw me come out of the trees. You waved at me. I waved at you. You came on down and we went over and then got to actually like track what happened with Matt and actually see where this deer went and what happened. There was no blood, but we were able to find 5 of the 9 pellets lodged in tree branches. And when we say pellets, these are like ball bearings. They're buckshot. They're larger chunks of lead lodged in tree branches. It's like, okay, so the likelihood of this deer being down is very low. What we're going to do now is a very passive push. And so I sent you and Matt up. You went up to a ground blind that we had that covers kind of 2 different trails. And then Matt was going to push one of those trails to you while I actually bushwhacked. And as I walked through, you two would meet up and then you would go down the trail further and set up again in different positions. And I would meet up with you there. And I found so many beds back there, most of them fairly old, but 3 of them were really fresh. Like one of them looked like they'd been slept in just in the last couple of hours. And that was like, I don't know, 10 meters, 12 meters from that food plot that you were set up on top of with your stand. So there was a chance, depending on some point, that there was a deer less than 10, 12 meters from where you could have taken a shot that first morning. Because that bed was still warm when I found it.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's cool. Like Christina didn't bust herself up in the tree stand. The deer never knew she was there because the trail didn't look like it looked like it was going your way. And then around the time of that gunshot, the deer took off into the swamp. And so that was never on you. That was on the gunshot because that was less than 50 yards from where that other deer had been shot at. And it was so interesting just to be able to come along and take a look at like our work and your work and the deer's activities and how they're interacting. And just as I was getting to that food plot where you were put up, I just got a whiff of bear. I'm like, oh boy. And I just remember like that second day was actually that evening when you saw the bear, because we came back with Adam. Our good friend Adam and Matt and Christina and I went back out for an evening hunt on the same end of the property. And then it was Saturday morning. We went out with Adam, Matt, and Tom, and then did the drive. So for those that don't know what a drive is a way to try to hedge your bets to get the deer to go where you want them to go. You're going to manipulate them by having one or more pushers. And they're going to go to one end of the property and they're going to start pushing. And everybody else is set up at stands or watch points. And so we had Matt at a watch point way out on one end of the property to stop them from escaping. And then we had Tom next up on top of a ridge, being able to watch both sides of this hill. And then we had you where that cedar and that little sapling were set up and ready to catch any that tried to slip through the cedar trees and run towards the house. And then Adam further back into the trees. And then I went all the way back and covered this entire ridge. It took me over 2.5 hours to cross that all because of how thick everything has been in the last couple of years. And then coming out and watching how you all interact with each other, because that's the part that gets people nervous, is when there's other hunters on the property with you. And yeah, they're wearing orange, but you might not know where they're going to be. You may not know where they're going to pop out. And so what was going through your head, safety wise and hunting wise, of like, okay, there's now moving people where I may be shooting. What should I be doing? What were you thinking about when that all was going down?
Oh yeah, totally. I definitely had concerns. Like, my number one concern was me shooting a friend, and especially shooting like my super awesome friend, Caleb Musgrave. Like, that would have been my worst nightmare, would be to like shoot a human being by accident thinking that it was a deer. And so like over and over again over the weekend, I was like, check first, make certain that you're shooting at an animal and not a human. So look for the orange, use your binoculars, all that kind of stuff. So that was one way to feel a little bit better. And another was also to ask a lot of questions about the effective range of my firearm. And so in the car on the way to the property, I remember asking you several times, you know, how far can I safely shoot the gun? And, you know, is it possible that I could shoot something through the brush? And you'd say like, no, you can only shoot about 50 yards. And this is 50 yards from, you know, this house to Rice Lake, which was like, let's say five lanes of traffic on the highway, which helped me to visualize that a lot better. And, you know, there's so much brush and it's so thick here that even if someone was standing behind the tree line, you couldn't get through to them. And if you did by some fluke, you would have lost so much velocity and power that slug wouldn't have really hurt them. So that helped me feel better. But then the third concern I had was about me being way too sneaky and being way too well hidden, and someone maybe not being able to see the orange and then being like, oh, that's a deer, you know, and then popping me. And I got really paranoid about any noises that I heard behind me, because in the quiet of the countryside, which is not like Toronto at all, I kept hearing these red squirrels running back and forth across the barn and thinking, is that a raccoon? You know, is that a human like going through the brush? And I couldn't tell.
Right,
But I just had to trust the instructions. And, you know, thank goodness these were almost all people I've met before, but like all people who knew to trust your instruction and had been told where we're all going to be located. So we knew where we were. And so we just stayed put. And so no matter where we fired, we would have all been safe. And when you guys came down on that push on that drive, you totally yelled that you were coming. You're like, hey deer, there was no mistaking you as an animal because you used your human voice. And so like the safety measures that you had planned out ahead of time and like just a lot of questions and making sure helped me feel a lot better about maybe being injured or injuring someone else. Yeah.
Right on. So the takeaway I'm getting from this is coordinating with each other and talking with each other, communicating with each other, and making sure that everyone knew where they're supposed to be. No one's just going out for a stroll from their spot.
Yep.
They're paying attention to one another and they're communicating. Though usually what we do is actually we have radios with one another. And yes, we actually had that planned, but then I couldn't find the charger for my radio. And therefore we'd only have one radio in action, mm-hmm, which would have not been any use to anybody. And we had to, you know, figure things out from there. And so we actually ended up, even though you weren't able to join us on it, people like Matt and Adam, we were actually using text to communicate with each other. Like, okay, I'm at this location at this point. I will be in your area in about the next 10, 15 minutes. We were making sure, like, for me, I'm the number one liability when we're doing a drive. The pusher is the number one liability because they're the moving target. The people who are in position, there's no way you're going to shoot each other because you're all set up exactly where you're supposed to be and you're told where you're supposed to be shooting towards. You know where everyone is supposed to be, and therefore it's safe. But then you get this one guy, or sometimes more than one guy, who's just going for a walk. They're going through a walk for a walk where the deer are, because that's what they're there for. They're there to push the deer. Mm-hmm. And so communication for me was my safety, because I wasn't really likely to take a shot. The drivers often are the ones that do see deer. We're rarely the ones that get a chance to take the shot though, because they're running from us. And so unless you want to take a Texas bullseye, which is not something I ever recommend anybody do, for those who are curious, a Texas bullseye is the keister going right at the butthole. And the reason I don't recommend that is A, it's a really small target. It's a when you're shooting at the you know, the backside of a deer.
The deer.
Oh God. It's a lot smaller of a target than like the broadside of the deer. So A, that's a problem. You're probably gonna miss. Secondly, if you do hit, the hindquarters are where a lot of that good meat is. And if you don't hit it right in the colon, you're going to damage both either the left or the right thighs, and you're going to destroy all that meat. And the third reason is if you do hit it right in the keister, you're going up and rupturing all the organs, and all the organs are going to spray their juices, the bile, the gall, the kidneys, the urine sac or the bladder, the colon itself, of course, is full of fecal matter, and that's going to get all over that meat. So it's not a good shot to ever take. So as a driver, I usually am walking with my gun. On the chance I see a deer standing broadside, I can take the shot, but that is like a 1 in 100 chance of seeing a deer in that situation. So I'm mostly walking, trying to push those deer. So it's a danger. It's a complete danger. I'm a complete liability because there's a good chance someone might consider hearing all that noise of stomping and crashing and think that must be a deer. I'm going to take a shot. And so I'm always nervous, but I am always like very clear with my team, with my crew that I'm hunting with, like, where am I going to be? This is the trail I'm going to be taking. And then when I do get close to where I know there's going to be people, I try to get as far into the open as possible so they can see me and get a visual of me before I go back into those woods and let them know, like, have them now visibly see me and are now consciously aware that, yeah, he is in those woods. I need to be very mindful of what I'm shooting at. And so coordination is key and communication is key. Just like any good relationship, communication is key. Being able to communicate with one another and know that everybody's on the same page and on this in this for the same reasons kind of thing.
Yeah, like and the willingness to work as a team. Totally. Right? To stay put and to let someone say, this is the plan, don't deviate the plan, and everyone else being like, yes, you know what? This is the plan. We're not going to deviate it because it's a life or death situation.
Totally.
Yeah. So I just appreciated that a lot. Just, we were being very careful and, you know, we didn't, we heard a deer, but we didn't see any deer. But for like, no one got hurt. No one felt like they were in danger at any point in those 3 days. And that was really, that made me want to go back and do it again.
That's awesome. I really like hearing that. I really like hearing that. Yeah. And so now that you're looking back, you've had about 24 hours of not hunting, a little bit more than 24 hours of not hunting.
Yes.
And you've now hunted geese, you've now hunted duck, and you've now hunted white-tailed deer. I've got a couple questions for you, Christina.
Sure.
The first one is, what is your favorite one that you've hunted so far?
Oh, and deer. Why? It has to be deer.
Deer? Okay.
Why? Why is that? I think it's a lot closer to what animal tracking, like talking about my journey towards hunting and everything. I think this is closer to what animal tracking is. I envision animal tracking to lead me to, which is to use the skills of following an animal to make a kill for food. Right. Like it's a little bit closer to that trajectory for me. It's also, like, for I'm not saying that waterfowling is not enjoyable. I'm just saying that these past 3 days doing deer hunting were very enjoyable for me. Like, gotcha. And so I like that part more, like being in the treehouse and like being all camoed up and like seeing the bear. Like, they were all such cool things. So I like that. Yeah, I'll just say that for now. I think I might have more reasons, but I have to think about it a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. So my second question is, now that you've hunted duck, geese, and deer, what other animals are on your mind for hunting in the future?
Well, squirrels.
Ah.
Squirrels, because like I do have my small game license and they're a challenge. And totally. I've been told that they're really good eating. And I will never feel guilty about shooting a squirrel. unless it's a bad shot. Like then I would feel guilty. But like, you know, they're kind of, there's a lot of squirrels, they're not endangered. They're tasty, so like that's something I would definitely want. Totally. Anything other than that, I don't know. Like in Ontario you could go moose hunting, but those guys are a little bit endangered, and so I'm not sure I'd be comfortable going after a moose or certainly not a caribou or an elk.
Yeah What about turkey?
Oh, I'd try that. Okay. Like deer and turkey are both way overpopulated in Ontario. I would not hesitate to go after either of those. But turkey are hard. Like, speaking of dressing up in camo.
Right.
Wow. Yeah.
And they're challenging because you're calling them in like you do with a duck, but differently. And their eyesight is like insanely good. Mm-hmm. So like you have to be insanely good at camouflage and being able to call them and just get them at the right spot. Like I've shot turkey in the past. I think we talked about this on the wild turkey episode with Chris and Paul a couple of months back, or a few months back now. Actually, that was like back in April or May, I think. Wow. Anyways, like I've killed two or three turkeys, and they were all opportunistic shots when I was hunting other animals and the turkeys happened to be in season. And I saw the turkey and I had a gun that could take turkey load. And I was like, okay, I'll just pop out this round and put a turkey load in. And when they got close enough, I took a shot. It was never committed serious turkey hunting until this past spring. This has been my first year of legit turkey hunting where I'm going in full camo with decoys, with calls, and actually trying my best to lure them in. And it was a challenge. It was so challenging. It was humbling.
Wow.
Like it was really humbling. It was so humbling. I went out of the 2 weeks of turkey season that I was available. I was able to go out for 7 or 8 days and I never got them close enough to take a shot. Hmm. Never. I could see them. I could hear them, but they just would not commit. They would not commit to come in. Hmm. And so I found them really challenging and they've become kind of like my white whale now. It's like, I got to shoot a turkey on purpose.
Nice.
But yeah, there's actually a lot of animals in Ontario to hunt. Like moose hunting, as we've talked about on the moose hunting episode, which I think was our previous podcast episode, the moose hunting episode. Mm-hmm. I'm more than happy to take a moratorium on moose hunting for a few years and take a break and let the moose population figure itself out and let us see if what's going on. I don't know if I could ever hunt caribou in Ontario, maybe up in Alaska or Yukon or something. I could go for a caribou hunt because their numbers are doing a lot better up there. Mm-hmm. Bear hunting is something that I'm not opposed to. I don't bear hunt on the property that we deer hunt and turkey hunt and duck hunt on because the property owner asked us not to. They really, really love having the bears there and they want to keep the bear population. In fact, they're really happy right now because we're showing them all this footage of all the bear activity we're seeing while we're deer hunting.
Yeah.
But I'm not opposed to bear hunting. I've never gone bear hunting myself. I've helped set out bear piles or like bear bait. And I've helped people bring in the bear that they shot because they were big and they needed help pulling them out of the woods and stuff. But that's the one I've never done. And I'm trying to think of like what else there is to hunt in Ontario. There's like all the different small game, like rabbit, squirrel, rough grouse and doves.
I just thought like groundhog, because once upon a time when I had said I was interested in hunting, like long, long ago, I remember some farmer friends were like, you can come hunt our property for free if you take out those groundhogs.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting.
And groundhog is a good meat.
They only eat the finest clover.
Yep. They're mostly grass fed. They're part of the squirrel family. They're part of squirrel. They're part of the ground squirrel category of squirrels. And they taste fairly reminiscent of gray squirrel with a little bit more of almost like it's hard to explain. Almost like closer to like game bird. Like it tastes like squirrel meat with a little bit more of a game bird flavor, like quail or pheasant or something. And I think it's because they're living in similar climate and eating similar foods.
Huh. Well, that's something I consider. There's definitely a lot of groundhogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And for those who are like, oh, where's the groundhog on the hunting regulations? They're not there. There is no groundhog on the hunting regulations, but they're considered a varmint or pest animal for farmers, and hunters are allowed to hunt them for the farmers. And there's no close season for them, so you could be hunting ground. You could be hunting groundhog with a 22 or a 12, like a shotgun. You can hunt them with I would say probably number 5 or number 4 shot, maybe even up to number 2. But I would recommend 22s, 22 caliber rifles. Your classic rimfire, so like a 17 HMR or 22 long rifle or 22 short, they'll do well on a groundhog. And their hides are actually really tough.
I don't know. Because I've had some friends. Actually, I won't tell that story. Never mind. Keep going, Caleb.
I've made a couple of drum heads for hand drums out of groundhog, and it's pretty tough.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't get from being hit by a drumstick multiple times, it wouldn't break. And I've known a few people that have made like bow strings and bow drill strings out of groundhog hide. because it's really tough. And unlike gray squirrel is one of the more popular ones, because again, squirrel hide is really tough, but the gray squirrel stretches a lot. So it's not a great one for the bow drill, but I've heard of groundhog and I've used groundhog before, and it doesn't seem to stretch near as bad as gray squirrel does.
Maybe that Canada goose was wearing a groundhog vest.
That could be the case. Like, I was very sure that goose is wearing Kevlar.
Yes.
I was very sure because it didn't make any sense how that bird didn't drop. A similar thing happened this year on the first day that I went duck hunting. I went duck hunting with Matt and a couple of other good friends of ours. And all four of us shot at this one mallard, and it hovered for 5 seconds while we unloaded at it. And then it just started flying again. We're like, and we all just kind of stopped and looked at each other and looked at our guns and then looked at the duck. And we're like, how is that possible? Like, the one person, when they shot, I literally watched the wad of their shotgun nearly hit the duck. Which means
the duck is a shadow cat.
Yeah. Like, this duck is unshootable. And that happens. Yes. Like, sometimes you just, everybody takes a shot and the bird doesn't drop. And is there a possibility that the bird got pellets in them and they're actually injured? They may die later. There is that possibility. But that duck flew like 4 or 5 kilometers within our line of sight. We could see that duck fly away after being shot by 4 different people at the same time, 3 rounds each. So like a dozen rounds went at that duck. And it just flew away for like 4 kilometers and then disappeared off into the distance. So I don't think that duck was injured. I don't think that duck was harmed.
Love it. I can't wait to build up my own catalog of stories like these.
Right?
Yep.
Because you're going to miss more than you're ever going to hit. And that's just the reality of it. There's like a lot you can do for newcomers who are getting into hunting. Like, go to the range and practice with your weapon again and again and again, and try it at different angles, try it at different heights, try it at different elevations, try it at different sitting positions or kneeling positions or standing positions, and then go clay shooting and shoot skeet for a day and try to hit those clay pigeons at the right distances, at different ranges, at different heights, at different standing positions and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, like, in reality, all good plans fall away when reality hits. Yeah. Like, everyone's got a good, like, that there's always that boxing adage, like, everyone's got a plan until they get hit. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you're hunting. Like, you'll take that shot and like everything looks clean, and then nothing happens or something terrible happens.
Yeah.
And we're always hoping that nothing happens. If you have something bad is going to happen, you want it to be a nothing bad. You don't want it to be like that animal got shot in the hip and is ran 10 kilometers off into a swamp and we can never retrieve that animal. Like, you never want that. And we do everything we can to mitigate that risk. But sometimes things just go wrong.
Yeah.
And we always aim for safety. We always aim for ethical shots. And I said to you multiple times over the last couple of days, like, if you don't feel good, don't take the shot.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't feel good, don't take the shot. Because I'd rather you wave that deer away, like wave at them as they're running away from you, then you shoot that animal and it gets maimed, and then you feel horrible for the rest of your day, if not for the rest of the week. And if we don't find that animal, you may never feel good about hunting again. I've known a few people that had one bad hunt and they quit.
Yeah.
And that's totally okay. I'm not judging them for that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I've had a few of those myself, and there's been times where I questioned, why am I still doing this? But it's something that you've got to learn to prepare for and learn how to deal with and mitigate. And one of the ways to mitigate is don't take the shot if it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. I think the first hunts have taught me to adjust my expectations. It's totally not like they describe it in books or how they depict it on TV. All those hunts that I've gone on, I haven't usually seen a whole ton of things that I could shoot at. Mm-hmm. And if I go out there with the expectation of getting an animal and bringing it home, I've learned to realize that that's just setting myself up for disappointment. But if I go out there and I think, okay, I'm going to spend this beautiful day in nature with my friends and maybe I'll see something really awesome, then I'll never be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
like, if you didn't go deer hunting this week, would you have seen a black bear this past week?
Nope.
Yeah. And that's a really good way to look at it. I always tell people that I look at duck hunting as just water, just bird watching, and you happen to shoot a couple of them. Because like when we go bird, when we go duck hunting, we'll see like a half a dozen to a two dozen to three dozen species of birds, and only two or three of them are something that we can actually shoot for hunting. But we'll see like hawks and owls and herons who scream at us.
Yes.
Killdeers. That video that were you there yesterday when Adam was showing you the video from last year's duck hunting where our good friend Radic's dog stole my duck?
Oh, I didn't see that. That's really funny though.
So we bagged a couple of ducks and we had them on the platform of our blind. And Misha decided to snatch one and hide it and went and buried it off in the woods somewhere.
Oh my goodness.
And Adam recorded me losing my mind. I was so angry. I was threatening to, I thought Adam did it because there's no way that dog snuck between my knees and got that duck from between my feet. But she did. And I was so sure that Adam did it and Adam was messing with me that I was like cussing him out and threatening to drown him in the pond. He's showing this video and it's all the while you can hear this killdeer losing its mind, screaming just like 10 feet from us. And I was like, oh yeah, there was a killdeer there. And I started talking about the killdeer and Adam's like, I'm here making fun of you for getting your duck stolen and you're turning into a bird watcher again. I'm like, it's what you do. Like when you're duck hunting and waterfowl hunting, you're looking, like you said earlier, you get to see the sunrise and you get to see nature wake up. And it's such a cool experience. Like more people need to go out and experience hunting, in my opinion. More people need to. Even if they don't take a weapon with them, go with a group of hunters and just hang out with them and sit down and watch how it all goes. It's such a beautiful experience.
Yeah, it is. Because if you don't enjoy the outdoors or appreciate nature, you're probably not going to stick with hunting.
Yeah.
Like true. In my opinion. True. So like that stereotype I initially talked about being like really wary of, like, sure, you know, I'm still wary of that type of hunter. But through this experience, I've met so many people who aren't that type of hunter that I feel a lot better about having joined this community.
There's a lot of diversity in hunting if we let it. There's a lot of diversity. We've got, in our crew, we've got three people of Chinese heritage. We've got technically four, actually. And then one person of Guyanese, Indian, Chinese mix. We actually have two Guyanese that in the next year, one of our mutual friends is getting his hunting license to start joining us as well. And he's Guyanese as well. We have people that are Muslim. We have people that are agnostic. We have people that are Christians of different denominations. We have people who are indigenous. We have people of all different walks of life. We have people who are LGBTQ+ in our hunting group because that's what we wanted. I was talking about this with you the first night you were here. Young Bucks, our hunting group, we strived to like consciously recruit as many diverse people as possible to make sure this crew doesn't act like that stereotype of just a bunch of redneck, I wouldn't even say semi-racist, outright racist, the stigma of Elmer Fudd kind of hillbilly rednecks. It's like, I don't want that. I don't want to be part of a group like that. I don't want to be part of a group that says nasty things about women or nasty things about gay people or trans folk or anything. I want a crew that is supportive of one another, a crew that is loving and considerate of each other's beliefs and everything else. And it's been that. It has been that. And I'm so proud of that. We can make that. Anyone can make a hunting group. It's not like you have to like, it's not like starting a business. You don't have to go get like an LLC or incorporate or anything like that. You just need to find a few friends that have like-minded opinions of what you do out there hunting. And that's your hunting group. That's your hunting club. That's your hunting crew, whatever you want to call it. And we called our Young Bucks, my dad's crew, as I said earlier, they're the Belly Button Hollow hunting group. There's people all over that have their own hunt groups or hunt camps. Make your own. If you're really worried about people of that stigma that Christina and I have talked about earlier and I've talked about in the past, don't be part of that. You don't have to be part of that. You can become a new group. You can make your own crew. You can make your own family of hunters. And there's amazing organizations out there like the Hunters of Color. They're on social media, on Instagram. They're on Facebook, as far as I'm aware. They're an organization in the States that's trying to move into Canada as well, the Hunters of Color organization. I believe they're a nonprofit. And their whole goal is to get people of color, BIPOC, So Black, Indigenous, people of color, everybody out hunting and get them out on the land and enjoying it, because this land is to be shared with everybody. That's what the treaties say. That's what the Indigenous treaties with Canada and the United States say, is to share this land, to let people on this land to take care of themselves. And that's everybody, not just, you know, the guys that are Anglo-Saxons or Francophones. It's everybody, everybody. And I really do love that. That's something that I really appreciate with this crew. And it's why I'm so appreciative of people like you joining, like newcomers to hunting who are of different, diverse backgrounds. It's so awesome. It is so awesome. And it makes me happy whenever I get a chance to go out. Like I said at the beginning, you're one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. And the fact that now I get to go hunting with you, dude, that is so cool.
It is
so cool.
Yeah. Like, but just before we sign out, because I know it's getting late in the podcast and we should probably wrap it up soon. I just want to say to Dragonfly Nation, like, just how much I appreciate Caleb. Okay. And how much, like, yeah, it's your turn now. Like, I like, just, he functions as a knowledge touchstone for a lot of people. Like, he gets treated a lot like Google by people because he knows so much stuff about so much stuff. And, like, you know, you've seen it happen with him on this podcast. Anyone can put whatever question to him and he'll have an intelligent, reasoned answer to it, but he'll also give you his moral opinion about it. And usually it's extremely well thought out. And I just want to, like, point out that usually you don't see that marriage between both skills and knowledge and morality. Like, you usually don't see that in a person, but here's someone who's going out of their way to create, like, the world that he wants to see. And, like, you know, speaking of being really happy and proud to be associated with someone, I'm really happy and proud to be associated with you. And I know your screen's off right now, but, and you're crying. Yes. So don't worry, you don't have to turn your screen back on and show me your tears. Just collect them in a small vial and later I'll drink them.
My half-white tears?
They're only, like, half as salty as they should be.
It's like half and half cream for coffee. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, their diet.
I want to quote Dr. Evil, where he's like, you're the Diet Coke of evil. All the flavor, not quite evil enough.
Yes, we've talked about this, how I'm your ego and you're my id.
Yes, yes, yes.
And on that note, should we wrap it up?
I think we should. Well, thank you so much, Christina, for joining us tonight. I really appreciate this for you joining us. It's such a pleasure to be able to sit back and chat with you about something that we're both passionate about. It's really, really cool. And on that note, I also want to thank our listeners. I want to thank everybody who's tuning in, as well as especially our patrons at Patreon. People like Paul McCarney, Nikki Satira, Renee Nolting. So many people. I'm trying to remember the list. I may actually just do a second recording at the very end to list a bunch of other people, because we got a bunch of new members on Patreon in the last couple of days. So I want to thank all of you, because you're keeping the lights on here. You're keeping the power so we can actually do this stuff. All the equipment we're using for this podcast, the fact that we are able to access the internet at this day and age and actually have access to the internet is because of people like you. And if you yourself want to become part of Patreon, you can go to Patreon and look for Canadian Bushcraft. It's got the Dragonfly logo. You'll find us there. And there's a lot of different tiers and there's a lot of access on there. We're going to be actually organizing the next couple of weeks. Probably one of our very next episodes is going to be where patrons invade the podcast for the third time. We're going to be getting everybody together and having a get together and chatting about whatever they want to talk about. We're going to be talking about probably winter prepping for the winter time and what skills they should be practicing in the winter, asking different questions of all kinds, talking about shelter craft, whatever comes up to them, telling some stories, having a good old time. So you get access to that. You get to have the free show with us. You get to be live with us, ask all those questions. And then that goes up on the podcast later that week for everybody else to listen to, but they don't get to participate in the questions. They don't get to have all the fun. But also you get to have access to articles. We're putting out videos lately on the Patreon just for our patrons, so they can check out what we've been doing with the Quarter Acre Homestead and all of our little things. We're putting out some hunting tips. You're also getting discounts. You're getting discounts on courses. You're getting discounts on the Hunter's Journey course. If you go on to our Patreon, you can actually access that as well. Although I think it's closed now. I'll have to check with Chris. But anyways, I will thank many more of our patrons in one more moment. I just got to pull up my list of our new patrons and thank you all in a moment. But I want to thank everybody for tuning in as usual. Thank you for your patience as well. This is only our third or fourth episode for the entire fall because we've been so busy with the Quarter Acre Homestead getting ready for the big move. So thank you to all of you for your patience and, of course, for tuning in and enjoying the show with us. We'll see you again soon. And as usual, tread softly.